Hi, I'm Alan Alexandroff, and I'm the director of the Global Symmetry Project. Much of the research that we do at the Global Symmetry Project can be found at our website, which is globalsymmetryproject.com. It's my pleasure today to invite Eve Tiebergen back into the virtual studio for this episode on Shaking the Global Order. In particular, I want to focus with Eve on what's the state of the U.S.-China relationship and how is it reshaping the global order. Eve currently is professor of political science and the director emeritus of the Institute of Asian Research and the Kanwaki Chair in Japanese Research and also the director of the Center for Japanese Research, all at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. Eve is currently on study leave from UBC and is a visiting scholar at the Taipei School of Economics and Political Science for this academic year. Eve specializes in comparative political economy and international political economy with an empirical focus on China, Japan, and Korea. His latest book, The East Asian COVID-19 Paradox, was published in August 2021, and a forthcoming book is titled Game Changer: How COVID-19 Has Reshaped Societies and Politics in East Asia. So let's join Eve as he enters into the virtual studio to examine the U.S.-China relationship. So welcome, Eve. It's a pleasure to have you back in the virtual studio.
Thank you, Alan. It's a pleasure to join you again.
Yes, and I'm glad that your travels enabled you to sit long enough for us to have an actual opportunity to talk about particularly the U.S.-China relationship. So, Eve, the long-anticipated summit between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden did take place at the margins of the APEC summit in San Francisco, so that was kind of mid-last month. Can you give us a kind of big picture? How would you assess the results of the bilateral summit between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden?
Yes. So what's interesting is it was on the margins of the APEC summit, which mm-hmm. was hosted by the U.S. Of course, it has overshadowed the APEC summit itself, even though there was still a joint declaration, which is something. But that became the essential piece of this whole exercise. They met in Woodside in a in a fairly beautiful house, which, by the way, inside is designed to look like the Chateau of Versailles. So they met in a room that's decorated like in Versailles. Very beautiful room. I've seen pictures. And that's because the founder of the estate was involved in the Versailles, negotiated the Treaty of Versailles after World War I.
Oh, 1919.
And he was close to France. Mm-hmm. Very interesting story. That I was the first meeting in 1 year. Apparently, also they had no phone conversation between Biden and Xi in the entire year. Mm-hmm. So that shows how little they meet. You know, it was 2 hours official meeting, 2 hours lunch plus walk, so 4 hours total, and that's it for 1 year, right? When you think about it. So the deliverables are low key. There's nothing earth shattering. Obviously, it's not affecting the structural direction of the relationship, which is more and more competitive, more mm-hmm. and more fraught. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the big picture is we are in what realists call, whether it's a hegemonic transition or a power transition, but in one of those difficult structural moments where there has been a rising power, and now it's a little flat, but it's risen a long way, and is still a great power that has a declining relative power. And so no matter what, that structures the relationships in a fundamental way. In addition, domestic politics in both countries are fraught and very nationalistic oriented right now. So between domestic politics and the structure of the competition, it's extremely hard for a single meeting to do anything. But at the minimum, it gives a bit of time. What's clear is that the 2 months before the summit allowed to send signals. At least in China, it sends signals because it was coming. It was visible that it was coming, even though it was not confirmed. It sent signals to officials to open up and to talk to Americans. So there were a lot of American delegations.
Right.
And a lot of Chinese delegations to Washington. So that part is very, very important. The summit allowed for that communication, which then allows for adjustments of, information sheets to make sure there's not massive misinformation and misunderstanding on the two sides.
Right.
On the outcome side, number one, resumption of military-to-military
communication.
Mm-hmm. Number two, the green, that follows the Kerry Xie Zhenhua meeting, but the green agenda on methane particularly. Number three, management of fentanyl. The precursor chemicals. China was not extremely proactive and can do more to help out the Americans here. And then there's a bunch of small things like getting more flights going. At least doubling. There's so few flights now that they cost a fortune. And meanwhile, those making money are the Japanese, the Koreans, and the Taiwanese because everybody's flying through those three. And the pandas, there's no more pandas now in the U.S. to return to San Diego, not Washington. It's interesting. They talked of having more, American exchange students, up to 50,000. The number's abysmal right now. They talked of supporting a bit of people-to-people relationship. And then there was this, something I was watching. They had queued ahead of time that there could be an agreement on AI, on a banning AI-controlled nuclear weapon systems. They said it might be coming. It was 3 days in advance in the newspapers. In the end, that's not up there. They also said there could be an agreement on AI and security. In the end, again, it's not there. What we see instead in the communique from the U.S. side is two lines saying we have discussed the safety of AI and weapon systems using AI, and we are creating a working group.
I see.
So instead of a declaration that was supposed to happen as queued before, we have the creation of working group and bilateral discussions on that.
Why do you think that is? I mean, if there'd been talk of a declaration and now instead we've got a working group, I mean, was it that there was some issues dividing U.S.-China on that subject, on the AI subject?
So, yeah, I guess, rationally we can think there's two possible explanations. One is simply that it gets quite precise and technical, and it has to be done at the level working group
right.
process, and maybe not all the right people were there.
Right.
And indeed, there is no Minister of Defense in there. The whole military command is shaky right now in China. The other reason could be that they have some differences that have risen from their respective militaries. It could be... Because they were talking of automatic, AI-driven control systems for nuclear weapons, as well as automated weapons like drones.
Right.
On the drone side, they could be disagreements coming from one or two militaries. It could be technical level, or it could be... I don't think it's a bad thing, because indeed those are very complex, and we'd rather have them do a good job and do a proper arms agreement, right? Given how critical this question of automatic weapons driven by AI is, because if we go this way, as seems to be right now, And if any of this gets out of control, you know, that becomes the ultimate nightmare, right?
Right, because it's handled by AI and not by human decision making. So let me touch on a couple points here just to clarify. On the people-to-people, there, you know, China did express, aside from the airline flights, which we all are concerned with, direct flights to China, but on the people-to-people, apparently Xi Jinping did express a willingness to increase the number of China students to something like 50,000 over the next couple of years. Were you surprised, for example, that our friend Joe Biden said nothing with respect to things like people-to-people kind of exchange, and in particular the Fulbright program? He failed to mention anything about that?
Yeah, I haven't indeed seen or heard anything on the Fulbright, so that means it wasn't there, right?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the ending of the Fulbright program in China was was quite a political thing. It goes back to the Trump time, right?
Yeah.
And so maybe because it's highly visible and it's like it's a signal for something bigger. Maybe it's something that's too big to fly under the radar and would be politically impossible in the current context in Washington. It's the kind of thing that passed to the Congress would immediately go after. I'm guessing that this is that it's just politically impossible right now.
Okay. Turning to kind of the broad picture again, was there any advance lowering? Let's call it lowering the temperature vis-a-vis Taiwan, or was that again not something that really was directly faced by the two leaders in their meeting?
Oh, right. So there is no direct outcome, in sense of a communique or a declaration. But we know it's been reported by both sides, but especially the Americans, that there was a lot of discussion about Taiwan, which is interesting, right? Apparently, significant discussion that it occupied quite significant time.
Okay.
And both sides had very, all kinds of things to say. But we do know that the American side reiterated the One China policy and said there's no change to the One China policy. And on this regard, what's interesting is later in the Q&A in the day, there were some journalists saying they asked this similar question to Biden that he was asked in the past about military commitments to defend Taiwan in the case of a contingency. But apparently the question that came from a journalist was, given the wars elsewhere that the U.S. is involved in, Ukraine and now Israel, Gaza, is still ready to give that military commitment to defend Taiwan? That's, I think, what the question was.
Yeah.
What I read. And apparently Biden this time did not jump at it and for a fifth time commit against to bring to defend Taiwan military. This time he said there's no change of policy. We're still following the One China policy and the Taiwan Relations Act, which requires us to help Taiwan defend itself. But he did not say for the fifth time I would go in.
Right.
So there was a careful effort, and apparently it was well planned that he would not say anything about this. He was in the American team. Apparently one, I think it was the Nikkei that reported that this is part of the preparation with the Chinese, that, it was not sure that Xi Jinping would travel to the U.S. until the last minute.
Right.
And it was an extensive discussion about him not losing face, not being heckled too much, and not facing a declaration like this about defending Taiwan while he's in the U.S. And so apparently this is part of the diplomatic choreography to get Xi Jinping to come. On the Chinese side, we know it's been reported in various newspapers, although not confirmed officially, it's not in the transcript, but it's been reported widely by sources that are well informed that China, that Xi Jinping said, I read in the U.S. that there is talk of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan in 2027 or 2035.
Right.
And there is no such intention. I have not heard about it. Apparently, one newspaper said that was the Nikkei. And there is no such planning, no such intention. So he addressed those two dates specifically.
Right.
And then Biden, some further debriefing later, either by Biden or other people in the administration said, we don't see an invasion in the short term. So there was a lot of cooling on that side.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we know that supposedly the final word of Biden when he said farewell to Xi Jinping as he left the Filoli estate was, I don't want any election interference in the Taiwanese election of January 13th. So there was also discussion about that.
Mm, okay.
Even in that final comment, right?
Okay.
So there's plenty of Taiwan discussion. I think on Taiwan, the net outcome of all this is there was very good discussion of red lines on both sides.
Right.
And there was a degree of mutual reassurance by both sides. So if anything, it's cooled down a little bit, the temperature.
Okay. Well, not unimportant, needless to say. One other area.
At least for 1 month.
Yeah.
After January 13 and the election, we don't know.
Absolutely. And clearly that's in the back of everybody's head about the upcoming presidential election year and election in November. Let me ask one further follow-up. We've talked about Taiwan, and I guess the other area that, you know, clearly is of importance and related to conflict is the South China Sea. Was there any kind of further understanding about, you know, the American, of course, move, the FONOPs that have been underway now for quite some time, and or the, you know, the issues with respect to the Philippines and China, and you know, those issues related to the South China Sea?
I'm sure they talked about it.
Yeah.
I didn't see too much in the transcript.
Right.
We know from the public what filtered out publicly was the discussion on military to military communication was really centered on the South China Sea to have direct communication in case there is an incident.
Right.
One element that's related to South China Sea was the bilateral meeting between Xi Jinping and President Marcos of the Philippines.
Yes.
They met in a bilateral. And what came out of it was, at least the public side of it was Marcos saying, no side wants war. We want to find a way to manage this.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know what was fully discussed. I mean, I was assuming that this allowed to lower the temperature and try to instruct maybe at least the Chinese Coast Guards to stop ramming Filipinos' boats, right? On the shore. But, well, a week later, here we are, and again, there was a ramming and there was the use of a water cannon against, by the big Coast Guards from China. The super Coast Guards, but they're well armed.
Yes.
Against those light ships going.
This is the maritime militia, right? That they've constructed.
No, it's the Coast Guard.
It's the Coast Guard. So okay.
The official ships,
not the others.
Water cannons and all this.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happening is the Thomas Shoal, which is claimed by both sides.
Yes.
And has been awarded, the fishing waters around them were awarded by the UNCLOS to the Philippines. There was no decision on the ownership of the islet itself, but the Philippines in 1999 sank a ship there, an old warship called
right.
Sierra Madre,
right.
to claim the sovereignty. And then the Chinese were caught off guard at that moment. But now they try to prevent the resupplying of that ship. That ship has some Filipino soldiers on it.
Yep.
But it's also crumbling, so it needs both supply and maintenance equipment to rebuild and refurbish the ship. And the Chinese, you can get supplies, but nothing for maintenance. And I think that's what it is. And so they keep ramming the supply ship or using water cannons to
right.
put them away.
Right.
And that happened again after the meeting.
After the meeting, yeah. So, okay.
Yeah. So this is dangerous because Biden has said, on that one, he said before the bilateral meetings, he said if the Philippines ask us or if there is an attack on any military ship of Philippines, then bilateral alliance will kick in.
Right.
And there is discussion among, I think, between the U.S. and Philippines on whether the U.S. Navy should escort the supply ships. And that would be a huge escalation because then what will China do? Will they try to use water cannons against the U.S. Navy? Or so it's that's the tensest point, actually, right now.
Really?
Sierra Madre is dangerous point right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, kind of stepping back just a bit, how would you characterize the bilateral relationship at this point in the, with all the elements that you've just talked about in terms of discussion and or in some cases agreement? So where are we? What is the state of the U.S.-China relationship?
It's possibly asymmetric. That is, so fundamentally, it's structurally headed toward probably confrontation. So it's heading toward confrontation. It's in a very bad state, like in the early stage of what could end up being a Cold War, although we are too intertwined to really call it Cold War.
Right.
That's the structure. And so the meeting just gave a cool-off moment and allowed resolve, dangerous exaggerations or, try to solve a few technical things, but hasn't affected in any way the structure. So the structure is headed to a difficult times. Now, the next step is that it's asymmetric. On the U.S. side, there seems to be almost no change because the decks are stacked with a commitment to a competition, military pushback, alliance building, and then we are in an election year.
Right.
So there's no change there, structurally really headed toward, comprehensive competition or confrontation. On the Chinese side, there is a little bit of uncertainty. It could be a blip. It could just be Xi Jinping came and did the nice, he spoke softly actually in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Talked of cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
He said planet Earth big enough for both of us.
Yeah, right.
Biden said we're here to compete. We're going to compete intensely, but we want to avoid catastrophe. Whereas Xi Jinping said we don't need competition. We can cooperate.
Yeah.
Planet Earth can take both. So he was the softer speaking side. What we don't know is whether it's all, outward and, ritualistic and themselves lining up for very intense competition, or whether there's a bit of an opening going on now in China. And I've heard from certain sources, diplomatic sources, including non-Western one, that they thought there is a bit more opening going on in China right now. Other things have happened beyond the bilateral with the U.S. The most interesting one is the visa-free access for 2 weeks given to 5 European countries, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Netherlands. That is the first time that China offers this without the symmetric response, right? There is no visa-free travel for Chinese to Europe.
Right.
But in a natural opening. So there's a bunch of steps that show a period of at least potential opening within the Chinese system, also on the economy, a bunch of announcements. But we just don't know whether it's just blips or whether there's more of an effort to soften up, to relax a bit, and maybe to shift a bit the direction of policy. That part we don't know.
Okay.
But on the U.S. side, there's no...
There's no real change, right? Okay. So in that vein, excuse me, let me ask you, sorry, Biden held a short news conference following the actual summit. And again, he was asked whether she was a dictator. And he said, look, this is Biden. He's a dictator in the sense that he's a guy who runs a country that is a communist country that's based on a form of government totally different than ours. Why would Biden engage in such a discussion just following having a summit with Xi Jinping? Why do you think he, the question?
Yeah. So I have three reactions to that. Mm-hmm. First one is, first, on an academic or factual basis, it's actually correct, but anyway.
Fair enough.
It's a dictatorship. But number two is, it could be, Biden has been, is known for liking to speak of his mind. And he was on really intense self-control for the whole meeting and everything. And, you know, at some point, he lets go a little bit.
Okay.
That's what he really thinks. So you can't control yourself, at least, someone like Biden, 24/7, right? At some point, some real color comes out. And then the third explanation would be, politically, is that, it's an election year, and he's always thinking reflexively. Everything he does and says in China policy is reflexive with respect to domestic politics. And he feels, I've already engaged, I've done a meeting, I've done my diplomacy.
Right.
I have to balance that off by something blunt and for the domestic political context.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the calculated interpretation. But leaders are humans, and sometimes it's not all calculated. So I don't know if it's that or if it's the opposite.
Right.
Or
That's fair. So let me just finish up, because there was a second set of meetings, and this is meetings again at the margin, and this was the meeting of the IPEF, right, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is a grouping of 14 different countries, many allies and or partners with the United States in the Indo-Pacific. And this was established, these discussions, I guess it would be, is it 2 years ago now? Not quite. But the point is, the negotiations were over four pillars: trade, supply chains, clean energy and decarbonization, tax and anti-corruption. And at the end of the meetings, it was clear that the trade framework is not completed, and it may not, in fact, the negotiations may not meet the two-year deadline. What's the consequence of this going slow, to say the least, of the discussions over IPEF?
Mm-hmm. So first, it's interesting to note that, APEC, used to be a very, very important thing as a summit itself.
Right.
But this APEC summit, I see it as an inverted three-tiered cake, whereas, we used to have the base was the APEC summit as the most exciting, most important, and there could be bilateral or regional thing going on
right
on top of it. But this time, The summit itself was very limited. There's interesting language on green, renewable, food security, and that kind of stuff, but it's nothing significant. The second tier in the middle is IPEF, and is less consistent than expected, but there's still some interesting stuff going on. And the top tier was the bilateral US-China, and that's what dominates. Everybody will remember San Francisco from the bilateral. Now, IPEF remains interesting, but the biggest pillar by far was the trade, because it was not just trade, it was trade, data, and labor,
mm-hmm.
regulation, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the dominant pillar. And indeed, that one is crippled, will not recover. It's crippled from two sides. Well, first of all, he was crippled to start with because India decided to walk out, right, from many months back. So there was never going to be India in it. But now the U.S. killed it twice.
Right.
First on the data side, even though the idea was to use that to set more rules on the digital economy for partners and allies of the U.S. against China.
Right.
The decision has come within the U.S. that they prefer to retain autonomy, policymaking autonomy, than to make any compromise, because there was probably some requests from partners to do a bit of compromise, but it would lock U.S. policymaking into a set of principles or decisions that they decided we don't want to be locked. We want to remain totally autonomous on policymaking in the digital space. And then the second part came from Congress on labor standards and trade.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a pushback and a decision to basically walk away. So the U.S. is walking away from the trade pillar.
Even though they had initially proposed it.
Yeah. So what I heard in Singapore, for example, was that the IPEF was hard to swallow for all the ASEAN partners in particular, because it was a lot of demands, mm-hmm. a lot of sticks, but rules, but not many carrots. And they used a lot of credit doing this, but now they walked away from this, which uses even more credit. So there's a bit of a disappointment there for those who hope that this was going to create some regional minilateralism and rulemaking, and which would serve the U.S. But the other pillars did not have conclusions on the margin of impact, but they are continuing. So on supply chain, there was an agreement last May, and I think they're going to add something to it, that part on supply chain and emergency situation, right, like COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to lead to something. On environmental rules, there will definitely be more, and clean energy, there'll be more stuff coming out. Maybe there's disagreement now because many of those countries like Indonesia and Korea, who wants to export green tech to US as partners and are ready to follow rules, they embed a lot of materials coming from China, including chemicals or precursors, and the US is determined to cut those things. Or they have investment, like in the case of Indonesia, the nickel processing is heavily managed by Chinese companies doing it in Indonesia. Because Indonesia now bans all export of nickel, raw nickel.
Right. You have to process it. Right.
Yeah. But the only companies willing to put a lot of money in since 5-7 years ago have been the Chinese companies to do that, right? So the others have not come. And so now you have a nickel industry that de facto has a lot of Chinese investment.
Mm-hmm.
And so the US is saying, we won't take it. And that puts Indonesia in a bind, right? Because they they want to do a lot more with the US, but then they have this issue with the mm-hmm. critical industry. So, and then Korea has other problems similar like that. So that could create delays, right? Because that could hurt very much all those economies if they have to completely decouple from China.
Hmm.
So I'm guessing that this would slow things in the discussions.
Okay. Well, Eve, I want to thank you for such a broad discussion. I knew we were going to talk about COP28, but I think we'll leave that for another occasion. And I really appreciate the in-depth kind of analysis on the U.S.-China relationship.
Thank you, Alan. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
See you.
Bye-bye.